great to have you with us, Chris.
Yeah, better late than never.
We've got. Yeah. And you've just come in just in time with a really good question. So Dan, if you don't mind, so I'm going to ask you to repeat the question one more time so Chris can be involved in this one.
Is, if a player is 13 or older, is it easier for them to get into an academy now, get scouted now, than it was 5-6 years ago?
No, it's not easier, I don't think, to be honest. It's always difficult because you're competing against boys that have been in the system since they were 6 or 7 years old. So as if a kid gets signed at under 9, the gap between them and the top grassroots kids is pretty narrow, you know. But as it gets further down the line, because of the games program, coaching and so on, it gets wider and wider. So it's hard to jump across. It's always been that way, I think, Dan, to be honest. I don't think it's massively worse, except that, I suppose, standards are going up. Are grassroots standards going up? In some ways they are. Some facilities are better. Is coaching getting better in grassroots? Some of the games that I go out and watch in grassroots, which I've been watching quite a bit over the last couple of months, you know, it's got a long way to go to get up to academy standard. And bridging that standard, that gap between grassroots and academy is very tough. And the older you get, the harder it is to jump across.
We get so many questions on this live and just people sending us messages about their son. It's mainly their son, or it could be their daughter, that is the best player at grassroots and needs to be at academy, or they're too good for grassroots. What's the best way for them to get into an academy? And I always say, just because you're the best player at grassroots doesn't mean you're anywhere near the academy level. What is it that when you was at Chelsea and when you had scouts working for you that you look for in grassroots players that you think, do you know what, we could potentially give them a try at an academy?
Firstly, if the kid is the best player in their grassroots team, they're probably playing for the wrong team. They've got to challenge, they've got to find a way of challenging themselves, maybe go up a year, whatever it might be. They've got to be pushing themselves to get better and better. So it depends on sort of positional things and depends on ages. But, you know, football is based all around control, pass and move, variations of that. So they're the things you look for as a scout. And we dress it up in complicated ways, but it's all variations of control, pass and move, not necessarily in that order. So shooting is an extension of passing in a sense, it's technique. So that's what you're looking for, that control, pass and move. But as the players get older, then you know if they come across, they're going to have a lot of catching up to do. So you begin to look more for and try and find out, are they coachable? Are they good learners? Do they take information on board? Because we know they're going to have a lot to learn. So it really does depend on the particular requirements of the academy. But it's all variations of the same things. I always say to any experienced scout, just to watch, to find the best and the worst player in a game, takes you 5 minutes. Yeah. It's all the so-and-sos in between, the challenge, you know, who might be good or not quite good, you know, the what Steve Salas calls the CD players, you know, that's where the challenge is. Are they just having a bad day? What might they be in a better coaching? But the top players and the worst players, sadly, I think, are easy to pick out.
Chris, can I throw something at you? Two quick ones. Hi, Chris, by the way. Is there an age where a club starts to look for positions rather than players? So they feel like they're under 14s, you know, they've got 2 or 3 amazing right backs. So they're never going to think about trying to scout a player like that at that age group. Is there an age where they start to get really specific that?
And it's a massive mistake. But yeah, they do. I think the important thing for academies, you want to balance up different types of player. That's fair. You know, so if you've got, I was speaking to a head of academy recruitment just the other day, 2 days ago, and they were saying, we need players, more players with pace and power. And that's because they've got a lot of small technical players. So they're trying to balance up. And the thing is, in the academies, we're there to produce individual players that go into the first team. Or succeed in the game, individual players. Yet the mistake we all make, because we're competitive and if we're coaches as well, we want to create teams. And that's not our job.
But Chris, sometimes having a good structured team and a balanced team does help the individual development of players.
Absolutely. But it's, you said it, Sean, it's different types of players. You need different types of players around you to bring out your game. You need a top games program. But to pick up Matt's point, at 13 and 14, we need a right back. Really? You know, Sean, you'll remember, Reece James at 13 was playing in midfield and not playing very well either, as it happens. He got moved and then on from there, you know. So but, people can still change positions. But types of players, yeah, you need a balance of that. And I get that very much so, to bring out the best of people. When do they need to specialise? Every player, surely, in the academy should be able to play three positions.
Is the language different, Chris? Is it not that we need a right back, but is it we've got space for a right back?
Yeah. Now, yeah, exactly. And that is what happens. There could be a great right-footed centre mid. Oh, we've got loads of those. No, we don't want that lad and you, or girl. And you miss out on them or don't give the opportunity to them because, well, we've already got a few of them. So I understand you've got to have a game time and so on. But you want some versatility in players, not to a ridiculous extent. Look at, you know, your lad, Sean Alfie Gilchrist. Now, Alfie's playing right back in Chelsea's first team, but he was mostly a centre-back, wasn't he? I think growing up he can play right back as well. But he could play in two or three positions across the back four, and that's great. Reece can play in two or three positions, as we mentioned just now. That's good. You don't want to pigeonhole players, but yeah, we look in academies to build teams, and that's not always the best thing. That can distort our thinking a bit, I think.
Speaking on the topic of academies, Sean, could we start with one of the topics on academies?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you can get a bit lost in some of the questions because there was one I was going to talk a bit more about on the 13-year-old question again. But yeah, we can move on to the question because you were talking about the guy from Love Island that kind of went a bit viral this week with saying that if he had a kid, he wouldn't put them into an academy.
Yes.
And I think that caused quite a bit of debate. I mean, statistically, I wrote a comment on that post where I just kind of said, look, statistically, you've got more chance of your child being a footballer if you do put them in academy from a young age. You look at the recent England under 21 team that won the Euros, and it was something like 86% of the group had joined academies from the age of under 10 and below.
Yeah.
And it's common now with most footballers. So it is nice to say, oh, I'm just going to let my kid play and just let them find their own way. And yeah, when they're 14, 15, get them into the academy then. Yeah, that's great. Like, it sounds lovely, but it's not necessarily realistic for today's game.
And yeah, just for a sort of backstory for anyone that wasn't aware of the story, it was a contestant on Love Island last year who was a professional football player, was now playing semi-professionally. And he had been at an academy. I think he was at Manchester City, or he was at a couple of academy clubs. And he just had he didn't have a great experience in the academy system. And his response when questioned about it was, would you go through it again? And he said he wouldn't go through it again. He wouldn't put his child through it again. Now, my thing as a parent, as a coach, is that, yes, you would love your child to be a professional football player. I'm very realistic and know 99% of the players, including my son, are not going to make it as professional football players. So what I want and what I love about my son, who's an under 12, being in an academy environment, are so many different things, from just the structure, the professionalism, what it's teaching him on and off the pitch, the sports science, the education, just being in a professional environment where he can see a particular pathway. Now, I've not installed it into his head where he doesn't want to be a professional footballer. He would love to be a professional footballer, but he's very realistic, so doesn't want to become a professional footballer, but is taking everything that he can from the system. And even the most simplest thing, if you're lucky enough for your son or daughter to be in an academy, you probably have realistically a better service medically than what the NHS can offer. Just because of what academy sports science, the nutritionists, the psychologists, what the clubs provide for their players. You have, if you get injured, you'll get seen, you'll get treatment straight away. Whereas if you go through the NHS, Sean's got a point, but that's just one of the, that's just one of the reasons. And I've listed about four or five of why I love the fact, I would always recommend getting your child into an academy, not just to become a professional football player.
That's it. Also, in London, there's a lot of private schools that are offering scholarships, bursaries. Some of them are almost like full bursaries to go into these amazing schools that are worth so much money. So, you know, people are getting that opportunity. At the end of it, where, you know, Matt, we met Sean Chris yesterday at the gym, and he's just come back from America and been able to go and get full university degree out there from being in the academy system. Chris, do you remember Sean Christopher that was at Chelsea?
Remember the name.
And the other stat that I keep throwing out there all the time that I've seen recently, 96% of CEOs in America played elite college level sport. So bringing it back to what you're saying, Danny, the education that you get, if you do it the right way, it can set you up to be very, very successful in life. Matthew, you've had a different experience with one of the coaches that came into Gen Football recently, the lad that came out of Arsenal. He's had a bit more of a different experience from coming out of the academy program.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the important thing is, like, Danny, the way that you approach it and talk about it is like the healthy way. The worry is when players and parents enter the academy and the goal is to be a pro. That's where it gets difficult and tricky, and people need to be careful. But I was talking to a coach. He spent 10 years at Arsenal, and he kind of obviously loved his time at Arsenal, but essentially he's not a professional now, and he feels part of that is Arsenal maybe didn't do what they could have to prepare him for professional football. They almost used him a little bit as a phenomenal youth player, very effective and great for his age groups. But when it comes to the time to play professional first team, he didn't feel that was sort of addressed with him. And now he's 28, not playing football. I've not had a massive detailed chat with him about it all, but he's...
Like you were saying yesterday, Matt, you were saying that he was dribbling a lot in the academy programme and that's what his youth coaches wanted him to do. But then when he went into first team, it all became one touch and they were asking him to completely change his game.
Yeah, that's what I mean. At age group level, he was very effective and very, very good. And then he said when it started getting into the first team and training with the first team, everything was one and two touch and pass and move. He said out of his kind of cohort, it was only Jack Wiltshire that could make that leap.
Chris, have you seen that with a lot of players over the years that have a really good time at youth level, below under 15, even under 16, but then at the point where they start having to make the steps up to first team, what can stop players from making that step up?
Yeah, character and desire, in my opinion, because let's be clear about this. If we want our kids to enjoy sport and play sport because of all the great benefits that we all know, fantastic, absolutely great, sport for all, love it. If we want them to, or they want to be in the elite of any sport, then there's going to be selection. And if there's going to be selection, there's going to be disappointment. And a lot of the stories come out of that disappointment. So in academies, we have to handle it very well. But yeah, you can have a kid join at six. He's the best kid in his school. The best kid in his team joins in the great academy at 6, 7, 8 in the development center. Science at 9. Steam, great facilities, great coaching, great, you know, experiences. Sailing through, maybe doesn't get serious injury even. Sails through, gets 16, even maybe gets a scholar. And everything's in front of them. You know, it's a joyride. They're in a beautiful bubble, as we used to say. Then they hit men's football and they're totally unprepared for it. Both in terms of the difference between academy football and 3-point football, or, you know, where it really matters, where people's mortgages and families are on the line, it's completely different. And also because they are suddenly maybe coming up against hurdles they've never had to come up. They've probably always been used to be able to go past players. And then suddenly you're playing, if you're thrown into adult football, they're quick and they're strong. And you're not getting past them and you lose confidence. And so you start checking back and you don't do the things that were natural in your game. So it's all part of that preparation. And one of the big issues you have in academy football is when you get to the players' age that Matt is talking about, is the space between academy football, because under 21's academy football was almost pointless, in my opinion. It's so, you know, pass, pass, pass. There's no guts in the games often. There's no desire and fight. It's very unlike the football that they're being prepared for. They go out on loan to League One and League Two, and that's totally different from what they've grown up in. So I'm a big fan when you hear about players at 16, 17, 18, they want to get on to, you know, to be professional footballers. I say to them, go and play in non-league. If you're playing good standard non-league at 16, 17, 18, the scouts will come and watch you and you will learn a lot. And I think there's more to be learned at the good levels in non-league, where it might be just a few hundred people, but they're paying to watch you. And the players are getting paid and it matters with that 3 points on the line. I think players can learn a lot more in the short space of time than they will in getting it going into under 21 football.
But this coach I was talking to said he feels that the loss of competitive reserve kind of football is massive. He thinks that competitive reserve football should be back because you're then playing against first team players. Yes.
Well, and of course that has completely died out. As a kid, I used to go and watch games with my dad, and if the first team weren't home, you watch the reserves, and if they weren't in the first team, they're playing in the reserves. That's never going to come back because of the squad game, but you're absolutely right. We've got to find ways to make it competitive. Neil Barth, now director of football operations at Chelsea, used to say, if they put up a prize, the Premier League put up a prize of £10 million for under 21 football, then it'd change. Then people start taking it more seriously. Then there's something to play for. Something's got to be introduced, or ways have got to be found to bridge that gap for players coming out of academy football, which is can be great development, not knocking it at all. It's, you know, it's home ground for us. But that step into men's football or women's football, because I imagine it's much the same in the girls' game, the women's game, that space between academy and top level is tough. Very tough to bridge.
Dan, I know you'd be keen to keep us moving and I like the, you know, the tempo of questions, but just one more for Chris. So Chris, you said that a lot of players are underprepared for the adult game. Who's to blame for that?
The academy.
Right.
It's our job in the academy is to prepare people to be professional footballers.
But what about the ownership of the parent and the player?
No, the academies have to take responsibility. If they make suggestions to the parents or agents, as they may well have by that age, and they don't take them up on it, that's a different thing. But we have to find a way. It's not beyond us, surely, in academy football, to find a way to make it more competitive. Either, as Matt says, you try and find a way to, you know, or you get another games programme as well alongside. So, you know, the experience of clubs like Brentford that did away with their academy, or they're bringing it back now, set up a B team and played a series of games. And they would play some good standard fixtures and they would play European teams as well. And that seems to me a very interesting model of, rather than having under 21s in a pointless league, why not have them just, you know, playing games they could play, as they often do midweek, against non-league teams, senior teams, all sorts of different teams, lots of different experiences. So it's up to us in the academies to get that right. That's part of our service. And it's in our interest as well.
And do you think so? Sorry, one more on this point, but do you think that problems like that happen in academies because kind of like the Premier League or the FA give academies a structure and say, right, follow this. This is your template. And academies just kind of like passively follow it and say, yeah, all right, we'll do that. Whereas like Brentford have gone, no, we're Moneyball. We're doing something a bit outside of what's given to us. And that kind of like entrepreneurial sort of like creative method they've come up with has worked for them better.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And look what's happened to Brentford. They got into the Premier League and as I understand it, they've sort of been told, well, you're supposed to have an academy now.
Right.
And they've got into doing it. Now, would that be their choice? I don't. Maybe that would be their choice to do it again now. But it's not the only. It's not one size fits all. When you look at some of the smaller clubs, some of the Cat 3 academies, and you can go and watch their games, as I have over years, and they are not better than often than the best of grassroots football. And you and the facilities aren't great. And you do wonder what's the point of having those, and wouldn't they be better putting that resource into, you know, a good under 21 team or B team that could play a whole series of different games?
And this is what I would say with regards to a lot of parents chasing Cat 1 clubs. They want that Cat 1 status. If you was to look at the amount of scholars and youth team players that are signed by Cat 1 academies from Cat 2 and Cat 3 academies. So if Cat 2 and Cat 3 clubs weren't developing players, Cat 1s wouldn't want anything to do with them. So as a parent, if you're just like, I just want to stay with a Cat 1 academy because they develop the best, they're the best. Look at all the clubs that are signing Cat 2 and Cat 3 players. So it's just about the development, but you're not always just going to get the best development at a Cat 1, because the amount of players that will get released at a Cat 1 and then at an under 16, a scholar will get signed from a Cat 3 or a Cat 2, and that's just the start of their journey.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Shall we, because I'm conscious of time, shall we move on to the subject that we were advertising and we were talking about before this episode, yep. Dan? Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, like, I was listening to this podcast that was talking about growth hormones that are happening a lot with parents in America. And I was just really surprised by that. But then I then started to think, wow, is that going to happen in England? So I think before we get into that subject around growth hormones, I think it would be interesting to put it to you guys to hear from you about how important you think height is for footballers. And Matthew, you haven't spoken for a bit, and you're probably the tallest of the group. So and give your opinions on that.
I'm not the biggest fan of clubs kind of having this fixated idea on a certain height. You know, goalkeepers should be 6'4" and above. I think I've got a good background in a variety of sports as well, and kind of the S&C world. So, you know, things like a goalkeeper should be 6'4" and above. Well, I know you could get a keeper at 6'2" that can jump higher than a keeper at 6'4" with good training. So when they get really, really kind of strict in detail like that, I don't quite understand it. But football is incredibly athletic. We can't forget that. If you start to get towards the shorter end of the spectrum of height, then the chances are it's not just that you're short, but just athletically, you're just probably not going to bring to the table what somebody that's 5'10", 5'11", 6 foot can do. So yeah, I don't believe in having specific kind of criteria for positions, but you do have to understand it's an athletic game. And when it comes to exactly what you said, Chris, because me and Sean did a podcast with the boys at Scunthorpe. And what you mentioned is exactly what they mentioned. Our mortgages are on the line. You know, when you play the lower league football and the money's very serious and it's a job, and then all of a sudden you might be a very, very good 5'7" central midfielder, but you're playing against a 6'1", robust, strong, heavy tackling central midfielder. It's competitive men's football. It's what it is. So... yeah,
I think if we look at the facts or the evidence, the average height of a Premier League footballer is 1 meter average for all positions, 1.82 meters. So that's just over 6 foot. The smallest Premier League footballer currently is Tariq Lamptey, I think, who is 1.63 meters, which is 5'4". Now Tariq is not having a bad career, is he? You know, and at Brighton and Ghana, and doing very well. and look at all the great players they've been that have been smaller players, you know, your Xavi and Iniesta, Messi and so on. N'Golo Kante is a good example because N'Golo Kante, who's had a fantastic career, of course, was not particularly tall, is not particularly tall, what, 5'6", something like that, but he was strong. So I agree with you, Matt. It is an issue when you come up against the bigger players, but the smaller players, even in those circumstances, can compete if they're strong. And there's nothing to say that just because you're smaller, 5'5", 5'6", 5'7", you can't be don't strong as well.
5'7", guys. Don't knock the 5'6", 5'7", guys.
There you go. I would never knock that. So you're right, Dan. But you can be strong. So, and strength is important, not height necessarily. Now, we know some coaches love a big player. I was in Italy last summer, and I was reading that Jose Mourinho's Roma, in their 25-man squad, had 14 players who were over 1 meter 90. So you're right, three goalkeepers, and the other 11 are all outfield players, all over 190. Average height of goalkeepers in the Premier League, 194. So I think it's still the case, Matt, that I would agree with you. You can get different size keepers that can compete and can do very well with more athleticism. But the argument has been, in a physical environment, if you can get a good one at 6'4", 5", why wouldn't you?
Exactly.
As a one is at 6 foot. So there is that's still there. The most expensive goalkeeper in the world, I think, still, Kepa, 70 million. I would guess he's 6'1", maybe. He's not one of the biggest ones, is he? But he ain't playing at the moment. And the two guys they've got in there are both 6'3", 6'4". So the goalkeepers is tough at the top because you're competing against people who are good and tall. But elsewhere, there are loads of small players do well and have great careers. So no, it's not a requirement at all. Strength is, but not height.
Can I pick you up on the data, Chris, when you said that the average Premier League player is 6'1", is that including goalkeepers?
Yeah.
Because my research showed that the average Premier League outfield player is 5'11".
Yeah, 180. Yeah.
Right, okay.
One on average.
And then the average midfielder in the Premier League is 5'11".
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it does... I've looked at it. I mean, like the teams like Burnley, West Ham, teams in the Premier League that are so good with their set pieces. If you're a team that just has too many short players, then you are going to be vulnerable. I remember back in the old days, they were trying to target Ashley Cole at the back post because he was a shorter player. I don't know if you remember that, Chris. Yeah. And it is a disadvantage from set pieces. So I feel like you need to have a mix of taller players in the group. But then, and then, yeah, like, you know, if you look over the years at like best centre backs, best number nine, I say it with number nines, I don't feel that you can be a number nine who's slow if you're not tall.
I agree. Where,
you know, your Agüeros, Jesus, you know, these centre forwards that are quick, they can get away with being shorter. But then centre backs, I know you might have like Martinez, there might be like smaller ones, Ake, but they, I mean, yeah, Ake's playing in a four. He plays in a four at the back. But they're very, very possession dominant City. Someone the other day said to me, like, Rodri is better than Busquets because Rodri has all the ability of Busquets, but has the physicality that Busquets didn't have, which I think is a fair point.
I want to change the same topic, but in terms of bringing the age group down. So these are non-professional players. So if you have a grassroots, so if we're going under 15s and lower, I personally feel if you're in an academy already, the academies have an idea and they know the players already. If you're trying to get into an academy, height will make you stand out. But Chris has said it. It's not just about height. How physical can you be? And I think academies, scouts, coaches, they're aware of that. So for some of sort of the viewers and listeners watching this or watching this back, if you have a son or daughter and you're trying to get them into an academy, or you have an academy son or daughter that you want to know if they're going to make it. I personally feel from conversations I've had with agents and looking at players, the first thing you look for on a pitch that will stand out is someone either talking or physically how they look. They're the first two things, even without out of possession, you will hear somebody, and then what is somebody like? How do they look on the pitch? So the bigger players will always stand out. But then more importantly for me, what do they do on the ball? So Chris has hit the nail on the head. It's not, if it was the biggest players, then that's fine. Smaller players, how can they use their body? One of the comments was, they might not be physical, they might not be tall, but they might have a brain. And academy scouts and managers know this. But realistically, if a scout is going to watch a game and they're looking at a player number 10, and then all of a sudden they see a number 6 who just looks big straight away, he's like, oh, what's he like? And so the height, I feel, is an advantage. But then again, it's about what they do on the ball.
I'm going to throw it a little bit anecdotal story, but it was, I mean, one, Chris, like I say, height is, I don't believe like height should be a criteria, but in terms of physical capacity, agility and strength is so much more. And that does come in different heights, but typically is still related to height. You know, the Canties of the world, they are anomalies almost. They do happen, but typically a more athletic player will just come with a bit more height. But like 100%, height shouldn't be a criteria, in my opinion.
But what do you mean?
Wait,
Matthew. Height shouldn't be a criteria. What do you mean? What, anywhere on the
shouldn't?
Field? Why not? Height shouldn't be a criteria.
Why should a goalkeeper that's better than another goalkeeper, but a better goalkeeper is 6'2", but there's another goalkeeper that's 6'4", but a 6 foot good two goalkeepers better?
Yeah, that's a marginal difference, But if the goalkeeper's 5'5" and is coming out for corners and getting bullied.
Yeah, but from what the conversations I've had with people is like, oh, if a goalkeeper is at least 6'4", they won't even look at him.
I'm sorry, just to go off one of the comments, clubs and recruitment will look at parents. So an under 9 that's small isn't an issue. They will look at the parents. If the parents are small, then they know in the 3 or 4 year plan is yes. So in terms of one of the questions there, if your child is a small under 7, under 9, under 11, puberty, growth spurt, clubs will look at the parents to see what the genetics are like.
Dan, I wanted to talk about this. Sorry, do you have more to talk?
No, that's it. That's it.
I was just going to say exactly what you said, though, Dan. Like, it's going back many years, but the team I was involved in with a youngster was like, it was national level, unbelievable team. Starred Colton Cole. Now, Colton was the one that went on to play pro, and he deserved everything he got. He was phenomenal. It wasn't just because he was 6'3" at the age of 13. He was phenomenal with the ball at his feet. But then no one else from our team made it. And our team was incredible. And part of that was, I know some of the scouts from back in those days and the coaches from back in those days, it was like, you watched that, you just saw Colton. He just stood out. He was 6'3", strong, powerful, would score a hat-trick every game. And you just couldn't take your eyes off him. So yeah, I definitely think for what you mentioned there, like youth football, Dan, it's...
Yeah, Matthew, like what you're describing there, that's a player who is effective right now, has got ability on the ball, and is going to help win games. That is so easy for academies to pick that type of player. And then going into this sort of like conversation around, do clubs look at the parents? Yeah, they do. They do look at the parents.
Sorry, and, Sean, can I just say, and this is why this project that Sean has created is perfect. We're not trying to sell you a dream. The people that Sean gets as guests and to give their advice and guidance know what they're talking about. And we could tell you everything that clubs and agents want to tell you that sound good, but we're telling you the truth. And whether you like it or not, there's politics in football, there's politics with agents. These are the facts. Sorry,
like,
Sean.
Like, no, all good, all good. I mean, it's still kind of, it gets to me that we look at parents because it's quite unpredictable. I feel that we've got to have some sort of like better technology. There's got to be something that can be better than...
But you say that, but the data says that the general rule of thumb is the average height of mum and dad's plus or minus a couple of inches.
And there was a program.
But Matthew, how tall are your mum and dad?
I'm a bit of an anomaly. I don't fit the 90% of what occurs.
That's what I'm saying. So you're 6 foot. You're 6 foot three. Your mum and dad are something like 5'7", 5'8". Like you both say about you and your brother, it's crazy how tall you both are. So there are exceptions.
Sorry,
Dan.
The perfect example for this, Crystal Palace released a documentary, a 4 or 5 part documentary, and they were going to offer a scholarship to their... They weren't sure whether they were going to offer a scholarship to their goalkeeper. And if anyone hasn't watched this, get it up on the iPlayer or Google, YouTube it. But their goalkeeper, if your son or daughter is in an academy, every 2 months, every 6 to 8 weeks, they will get tested, their height. And they looked at the goalkeeper's growth every 3 months to see if he was still growing, if there was going to be a growth spurt. And this is where parents need to understand that documentary got so much negative feedback, but that is football. And that's what it's not all roses. It's not all it is a business at the end of the day. So although parents don't like it, the amount of financial backing that owners and youth departments put into developing youth players, they have to take everything into doing fat tests for players. Chris, you'll obviously know a lot more when you have to look at players and what you're looking for. But this isn't new, is it? No. Looking at parents' heights and...
No, years ago, they used to do bone tests to more, or allegedly more scientifically calculate, estimate future growth. But they don't do those because they're felt to be invasive now. But there's all sorts of things that go round, you know. Sons always outgrow their mothers. All these sorts of stories and so on. Just looking at a player, the broad brush thing for me is if their legs are longer than their torso, they've got more growing to do. If their legs are shorter than the torso, they're not going to grow so much. That's a broad guide. But all of these things are factors that come into our thought process, because Dan, you're absolutely right. The thing with academies is it's not just that kid they're making a decision on. They've got choices, and you're looking at managing risk, because it is a business. It is, you know, the big football factory in that sense, for good or bad. And you are managing risk. And if we're going to put a lot of resource into this kid, but he's never going to be strong enough, again, I come back to it rather than tall enough, and some academies will say not tall enough, I do accept that that happens, then you're going to look at all the factors. How big are mum and dad then? If the kid's an absolute worldie, you don't really care. If it's Messi, who cares how tall his mum and dad are? Well, there aren't many of them about, are there? So you're looking at all these other factors to help you make a decision, because we're all guessing what the future is going to hold. We're all searching for clues as to what this player is going to be like down the line. And so you try and get all the information you can. If mum and dad aren't particularly small, what about the rest of the family? Again, you wouldn't make a decision based solely on that. The heart of it will be the ability and the potential of the kid themselves. But these are all things that you would have to take into account.
That's really, really well explained, Chris. And I've got a question for you in a moment. But just to add to what you said there, I think that it's important for parents to understand that, in my experience, when academies are choosing players and they're thinking about the factor of height, if the player isn't showing that they've got like great speed, that then becomes a factor. All right, well, are they going to be like very, very tall? Because also, if they're not super intelligent and very, very technical, then you're like, all right, well, maybe they could still be effective and another way. And then I think that's when height becomes a lot more important, because if you struggle there and you're going to try and be maybe long term going to be maybe in a defensive position, then they really want to know that are you going to reach certain heights? Because obviously we said earlier that the average defender in the Premier League is over 6 foot. So, Chris, a question for you. I don't know if you know this answer, but do you know roughly what it costs for an academy player to be looked after by, let's say, a Cap 1 academy, like per year?
No, but the average academy's got, what, 170, Cat 1 academy's 170 players, and they're going to be, you know, 9 million, 8, 9 million to run. So someone with better maths than me could work that out.
Brentford, when Brentford got rid of their academy, they, part of their sort of, the document that came out explaining why was because they were saving 12 million a year. And that was, I don't know, was it 3 or 4 years they didn't have an, but that is however many years they didn't have an academy, they were saving. So all these parents that want to moan about my academy's not doing this or them, yeah, clubs are investing between Chelsea, Man City, 8 to 15 mil a year on their academies. If Brentford done 12 mil.
Yeah, but then if you're selling players, I mean, Conor Gallagher, he might get sold in this window for 80 million. You know, the clubs can be producing so much money if they're actually an
and that's where it's a business. Yeah. That's where parents need to understand this is a business.
But just on the math that you just then described, Chris, and this is rough back of a napkin math, but 9.5 million divided by 170 players would work out to be £55,000 a year that they would have to attribute to your child being in the academy. Now, you can imagine then, because I've been hated, and I've been like, look, the lad is effective. Doesn't matter that his parents aren't tall. He's going to be good for the next couple of years. Let's get him. Let's sign him. He's going to be good. And I feel like the restraint is that, no, Sean, he costs 55 grand a year. We have to try and gamble that this kid is hopefully going to be there. But man, how hard is it to do these gambling from under, especially from under eights, under eights, under nines? It's tough.
Yeah. Well, you know, I said before, I think that these people who come on and say, well, I saw Marcus Rashford play at 7 and knew he would play for England. I always say, well, you should come and do my job because I can't tell. I can't tell that far ahead because there's too many variables. So you can look 2-3 years ahead. So if a 7-year-old comes in, Sean, I think it's reasonable that you say, well, do you think we'll sign him at under 9? Is this signing? If he's a 14-year-old, you might say, well, do you think we'd offer him a scholar in 2 years' time? I think that's a reasonable thing. Because of that investment and because of the, you know, the amount of resource and time and effort that goes in, but we can't guess too far into the future because it just becomes meaningless, you know, it becomes pointless. And all these people are reverse engineering back from when Jude Bellingham, you know, is arguably one of the best players in the world now. Oh, yeah, I knew he was going to be a whatever, you know. No, I watched Jude make his professional debut as away at Portsmouth for Birmingham City, and I knew the family. His dad played for me when I was managing Cheltenham Town.
Oh, wow.
And I thought Jude, Jude, I was doing a report for Chelsea on Jude, and I said, I think he's going to be a good player, and I think he could be a Premier League player. That's as much as I could say watching him at 16 coming on for Birmingham City. I couldn't have guessed that he would go on to be the best, you know, one of the best midfielders in the world at Real Madrid. And that was, what, 4 years, 5 years down the line. That was, I can't guess that far ahead because of all these variables, you know, the player, their mentality, dealing with problems that come up, their resilience, all the issues around. You can only look a bit ahead, and it is a business. And you're managing risk.
How many players? Chris?
Yep, sorry. Say that again.
Sorry. How many players are you allowed to sign in each age group?
There are limits all the way up, and they change. I think it's about 24 for the lower ones. Not every club will go that high. And then when you get to the scholar age, it's restricted to ensure, because they're only, obviously, at scholar, you don't usually play under 17s, it's just 18s. So it's reduced down again then in the number to ensure game time for the players. So there is a cap on it. But of course, other clubs in the past have managed to get their full quota at 13 and then have a shadow squad where they try and take another 20-odd players out of the market as well, you know, underneath it, although they're not actually signed at that age. So he's trying to take players out of the market, which is I think was wrong, and we never used to do it. But
it is gambling. It's like playing roulette, because if we don't know how they're going to go, then it's better to sort of like hoard as many players as possible, because that's going to increase your chances of producing a pro. So many variables.
The only thing is, Sean, with that is that if it restricts the game time that the other players are getting, they're not going to develop as much. So there is a consideration that says you have to keep the numbers down anyway, unless you're going to run, you know, two lots of games, which obviously does happen with some of the clubs with bigger squads, because you just don't, they just won't get enough game time, enough contact time. And there's a limited number of coaches, limited facilities. So there's other factors that will keep the squad size down, as it should be, reasonably.
Okay.
But it is a gamble.
Can I just say, somebody's made a comment. Game time. So as a parent and as a player, they're the two most important words that you need from 16. Once you're a scholar and you're in at full time, because now it's your full time job and you're that much closer to making it professionally, game time are the two most important words that matter to you. It's not about staying at your Cat 1, Cat 2, Cat 3 academy club, training there every day and not playing, but it looks good on your Instagram, you're carrying your designer boot bag and all of that stuff. It's about game time, and there's so many under 21 players that want to stay in their comfort zone, and that's fine. But the problem is, once your contract is up and you want to stay in the professional game, the first thing a head of recruitment or League 2 manager is going to say, how many first team appearances have they had? And as great as it is you saying, I've been at Man City's 21s for 3 years, starting every game, you've had no first team experience in any men's football. So game time is, Chris said it, that's the most important thing that I would always recommend to players.
Yeah.
Matty, remember when Luke Plange's dad, he was a pro at Arsenal in the under-18s, and he wasn't happy with the game time he was getting for Arsenal, so he joined a team in Middlesex in a Sunday league, and he was playing Sunday league football on the Sundays, yeah, to get the game time.
Yeah.
And we were springing up, I was like, Stefano, what are you doing? Like, you know, he's going to get injured. What if someone takes him out? And he's like, he needs his game time. But he's now a pro. He's now signed at Crystal Palace.
Someone said, what about game time for a 10-year-old? And there's so many parents that lose their head because their son or daughter isn't getting enough minutes. Enjoy the journey. Like, it really, like, as a 10-year-old and under 12, under 14 to an extent, because then you've got 2 years to get a scholarship. It's a long season. It is a long season. And clubs, it's a bold statement, but I genuinely feel academies will not, they'll spread out the minutes. So I doubt very much at an academy, your child is going to be getting the least amount of minutes. It will spread itself out over the season at academy football.
They're on that, Dan, I would say there's maybe a bit of an issue with too much game time at the moment with grassroots clubs, because they, you know, it's not uncommon now for a grassroots club to play Saturday league, Sunday league, organise as many showcase games of academies. Before you know it, they're doing two or three competitive games a week, and it's competitive games. It's not development games. There's very few coaches going out there setting up with a long-term plan of how can I make these players better. It's under 10 teams playing two competitive leagues, going out to win, and then a midweek training will be substituted for a showcase game against an academy.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you look back at how much time was dedicated to development, and then how much time was dedicated to like game time, which was just competitive matches, where they are literally, you know, yesterday there's an under 9 game, and I'm hearing the coach scream at his players, get on the keeper. And they're trying to score goals by taking a free kick from their own half. They have one player that's got a big strike. He takes the free kick from his own half. It's always a shot. But their tactic is the other players getting in amongst the keeper and put the keeper from trying to save it. So I think game time for grassroots is just something to be wary of, because match after match after match, competitive match after match is, it's something
Serena Williams, she didn't play a tennis match for like 3 years. Someone can like double check the stat on that. But the dad said she just needs to train. And like, I love that. Like, I think there definitely is a balance in worrying about game time, but also the training program.
And sorry, somebody, 40 Magic, your son just got 36 minutes this week at a Cat 3 Academy. If this consistently happens, bring it up in your review. But I can guarantee you, a lot of parents don't understand what happens behind the scenes at academies. So they will have to do a report of how many minutes each player has played. So at the end of the month, they will know if your son or daughter has only played 36 minutes. So it will spread itself out throughout the year.
Pick one point up. Matt makes a good point about getting a balance between games and training. I think at the younger ages, loads of games is not so much of an issue. But through my business, we assess players from all over the world. And I've done quite a lot of players in America. And the kids over there, 15, 16, 17, the parents are paying a fortune for them to play in their games and so on. And they want their money's worth. And so they are pushing the clubs to play 3 games a week, tough, you know, games. And so when I've been doing our assessments of players, I often find myself saying with the American to the American parents, look, he needs to play less. Physically, by the time you get 16, 17, you can't do 3 games a week at the top level of your effort and, you know, abilities. He needs to play less, but at more quality. So that balance is skewed in certain places around the world, certainly. And we're seeing it in this country as well, where kids are playing, as you're saying, Matt, and play. And that physically, that's okay when they're younger. It's not even physically good when they're older, because they cannot perform at a top level 3 games a week, 390 minutes. I just don't think it's feasible to keep that up. They're going to get injuries. They're not going to get their balance. They won't be able to give their all in training, because they've got to train hard as well. It's just not healthy. They've got to get a balance. It's all about balance.
Jim Fraser used to say to us that the match is the exam at the end of the week. The most important stuff is all the training program that's going on. And then they use the game to then see how they're developing from the training. Mm. And that should be kind of like the approach. Mm. So people like sometimes getting it the wrong way around. I've definitely seen it in America, where it's all about winning tournaments, the coach being the star, the parents showing off their children, especially on social media, long travel to games, yeah. You know, and you could just be using a lot of that time and effort in a lot more of development of the individual.
Yeah.
Awesome. It's gone fast. Like, we've got to the end of the session. I feel like I've just like gone into the questions. There's something like 40 questions in there that we haven't got to. I've screenshotted them. So maybe like next week, we can sort of like uncover some of the best ones and try and answer people's questions. But anything further to add from the group before we leave and for another week?
No, I just want to say, and I say it every week, sort of, this is about how we can help educate. We've given guidance and support to players, coaches, and parents. And everything that we say, if you can find 1% in something that we say that can help you, it's about trying to develop your journey, whether you are a coach, a player, or a parent. So although you're probably not going to agree with everything that we say, all of us four have a lot of experience in grassroots academy football, professional football. And that's all we're trying to do, is sort of, Sean set this up so that we can help educate, and we're learning at the same time, but we're trying to give our experience, and we're not trying to sell a dream. I had a message this week from a parent that didn't like how I was explaining something last week, because they was told something different from an agent. And I just had to explain to him, an agent's job is to tell you what you want to hear so that you sign for them. Whereas this program, the Project Footballer, is about telling you what it's like so that there's no surprises. I really enjoyed this week.
Cool. Yeah, no, me too. We've got a lot of podcasts about to be released. We've got 5 episodes. You're going to love them. They're all going to be like coming out in the next few weeks. So do catch those. Chris your scouting game seems to be progressing so well.
Yeah.
Great. Scouting game.
Yeah, so we do independent professional assessments of players from age 7 up to senior, and we do them by video, so we're able to work with players all around the world, and it's just booming along. It's great. Next one, we've got one in this afternoon. We've got to do in Canada, our first Canadian one. We did Irish ones, Cypriot, American. We're doing them all over, a lot in the UK as well, of course. All ages, all types of players, really interesting.
Fantastic. And Matthew, Gen Football is going from strength to strength.
Yeah, going very well. Thank you, Sean.
I'm giving you a chance.
I know. We I was just thinking when Dan asked me at the beginning of the episode, it's I guess so for us, Dan, another way to maybe put it is a player's ability to scan, receive the ball and move the ball. That's what we heavily focus on. And then with the tech that we got, we can start to objectify it a little bit and really work on those three core skills of a player.
There was something that I saw from you where you do reports for players and then you do the assessment, but then you then have such a good network in the game of people that can help the player with the areas of the game that they need to work on. But I was thinking that you and Matthew should connect. So then if you see players that need to work on that 360 awareness, then, you know, that might be someone that you put forward to Matthew. And I know you already know Danny. Danny, I mean, you're so busy with all your famous clients. You know, do you have any space in the week to take on more business?
I never say no to business. All right. My players are injured. A lot of players are injured. And one of the comments was, if you Google YouTube, Spotify, podcasts, Project Footballer, someone said, where can they get the podcast? So YouTube, Spotify... Yeah, and then you'll find there's a library of different podcasts that you'll love.
Cool. All right. Thank you so much, guys. All right.
Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.